first sermon in 21 years that I have preached on original sin, which makes you guinea pigs. And I thought that you should know what inspired me to do so. Two things that I want to tell you about. One is the woman at the farmer's market in August who came up and said to those of us gathered, "You're not a church that's going to try to save me, are you?" And we all said, "No, no, of course we're not." Her question, which was such a great question, has really reverberated within me since that time. And as it goes around and around in me, I've thought a lot about our quick response, "No, we're not a church that's going to try to save you." And as I think about that, what comes up for me is this question. Then if we aren't a church that's going to try to save people, what are we? What are we saying that we're doing? What are we about then? If we're not about trying to save people, then what are we about? And that path led me back to the doctrine of original sin, which you'll see by the end of this sermon. Now, the second thing that inspired me is Bishop John Shelby Spong. Many of you know him. He's Episcopalian. He writes a weekly blog. And in his blog last January, he decided to start a series that he titled Think Different, Accept Uncertainty. And it was to explore a variety of some of the major doctrines of the Christian faith. What inspired him was that he had just read Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs. And he was really struck by Jobs' motto for Apple. The motto for Apple for in its kind of creation and early years was think different. And that's what all of the employees were supposed to do. That's what they were supposed to help encourage other people to do. Think different. Now, those of us who are grammarians, including Spong, would say, too bad he didn't say think differently. So you'll notice that my sermon title is Think Differently. That's for the grammarians among you. And over the years, Jobs added a second part to it, to inspiring the Apple company. And the second part was accept uncertainty. And so Spong makes the case for, you know, for so long, we've been defending these ancient doctrines. We defend them. And you know what? What we've noticed is that over time, the church kind of seems to be dying in some cases. And perhaps the two are connected. That as we continue to try to defend these old and ancient doctrines, maybe that is some of why the church is in decline. And so why don't we look at some of those doctrines and see if we can examine them in light of certainly the advance of science that has happened in the last 2,000 years, but also all of the knowledge that we have gained since then. And then he says, but you know, deconstructing theology is easy. You can tear anything down and say, nope, we don't believe that. The tough part is reconstructing it. Any of us can say what we don't believe. How many among us can say what we believe? And that struck a chord, especially here at Montclair. Over history, we've been very good about saying what we don't believe, and not quite as good about saying what we do believe. And so this is one of those doctrines that we can really wrestle with. Now, Spong also points out, which I think is wise of him, and I think is also true, that one of the reasons that we in mainline denominations have not examined some of these doctrines that we've inherited over the years is because of fear. And here's what it is. There is this fear that any one of these doctrines could be the foundation of this entire Christian house. And if you pull out a plank with one of these doctrines, the entire house might collapse. And I will tell you that the doctrine of original sin is one of those. It is, in some ways, in many ways, the foundation on which the Christian house has been built. And so let's look at it. Let's see what we believe about it. Let's see how we might begin to think and articulate things a little differently. To help us, I wanted to remind you some about what the doctrine of original sin says. Now, many of you know that it has been responsible for a lot of its own evil in the world. Certainly, misogyny, sexism, puritanism, a lot of the things that have occurred because of it have been horrible, horrible things. So it leaves a terrible wake. Here's what it is in its basic form. Original sin says this, that God created a perfect world, and God created perfect human beings. And those perfect human beings sinned against God, made a choice against God, and in doing so, brought sin into the world from then on. But here's the part that you need to understand. The thinking about original sin in the doctrine form is that it isn't just that sin is sort of vaguely in the world. It's that in that instant, Adam's seed became bad, became sinful. And in every act of sex from then on, that bad seed was spread. You get that? And so, it led to certainly the doctrine that every baby that is born now with that bad seed. And so you can see logically where that leads, which we'll talk about in a minute. But it's critical that we get that part of it, that Adam's seed became bad, that it gets spread on to every single one of us through the act of sex. Now, the other part that we have to understand is that it was understood that, in the end, Eve was the one that caused it. Now, Eve would point to the serpent, as we heard in the story, but it's that's an important part of it, because you can see what has happened to Eve over the years, and therefore to women in general. We still suffer the effects of Eve being blamed for that act. Adam did it, mind you, but Eve was behind it. Eve was the temptress. And so we still, in the 20th century, saw women being ordained finally after 20 centuries. Women getting the vote. You think all of those things don't have to do with this? They do. They go right back to what happened with original sin, what happened in the Garden of Eden, and what Eve's place in that was. So now, the other thing that is important to understand is that the articulation of the doctrine of original sin is attributed mostly earliest on to Saint Augustine. Some of you might call him Augustine. He was the one who really took it and kind of made it a huge, 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 huge thing that then the church adopted. Now, there are many who would point out that it is no coincidence that Augustine created the doctrine of original sin at the same time that Christianity became the religion of the empire. So we heard that connection in the reading that Helen did earlier. And here's the connection that's made. The empire was well served by people thinking that they were totally depraved and in need of saving, because it would be very hard to subdue people who had some sense of goodness and wisdom and godness. It was much easier to subdue people who saw themselves as rotten from the beginning. And not only that, but it served the institution, the church as an institution, which it started becoming. Because then there was good reason for the institution. If these people are doomed, there needs to be a rescue operation. And that was the purpose of the church. So it's interesting. So there was a heretic at the time, and I have to say I'm becoming more and more fascinated with the heretics. So Pelagius was labeled a heretic, and Pelagius was in the days of Augustine, and so they fought against each other. Augustine won, Pelagius was condemned as a heretic. Pelagius believed that, no, people can choose goodness. And they don't have to have God's help necessarily in order to choose goodness. So think of it this way for a second. Think of it as you're in the water and you're drowning. Augustine would say, God doesn't just throw you a life preserver. God gives you a life preserver, puts it on you, and yanks you up from the water. Some of you. Pelagius would say, no, you're in the water, and you're drowning. And yeah, God might throw, you know, a little life preserver into the water, but you need to decide to swim over there and grab onto it. And then you need to further decide to actually get back in the boat. So you can see the differences. Well, if you go forward centuries, and mind you, this stuff was fought over every century in between, go forward to the time of John Calvin, who, as you all know, is considered to be the father of Presbyterianism. Okay? John Calvin had some very interesting beliefs upon which our denomination was founded. As Presbyterian seminarians, anybody who ever had to take the ordination exam had to learn Calvin's 5 points of theology, which were developed into a mnemonic called TULIP. And the T in TULIP is total depravity. You're laughing. This is our heritage. So the idea behind total depravity is that, just what it says, we are, because of Adam and the seed that has been spread, we are totally depraved. We cannot in and of ourselves choose any good without God. There is no goodness in us apart from God. Okay. The you, I'm not going to take you through all of them, but these two are very important. The you in TULIP was unconditional election. Okay, here's what it means. You do not make any decision on your own. God elects you. So it's that idea that you're in the water drowning and God reaches you and yanks you out of the water. That's God's choice. Okay, unconditional, not conditioned on anything, it just is. But many of you also know that Calvin also took that to a little bit of an extreme and came up with the idea of double predestination, which is some are chosen for heaven and some are chosen for hell. Okay, so there is election, but some of you will be elected for heaven and some of you will be elected for hell. And again, there is no choice. You have no choice, it just is. And if you're one of the ones that's chosen for heaven, you can't resist it. It's gonna happen, you're gonna have to say yes to God eventually. But again, it isn't anything you do, it's not your choice, it isn't anything on your part. Okay? So, so that was John Calvin in the 17th century. And you can see the connection back to original sin. Now, there were others in that time that argued for other things. There was one main guy, another kind of seen as heretic, called Arminius. And Arminius had a slightly different take on it. His take was, well, this whole thing about election is, it isn't that God makes that choice, it's that God knows who's going to choose God and who isn't. So God just has foreknowledge. So there are all these kind of different adaptations about it. Well, it's helpful for us to know that this is where we come from. There are many people in our Presbyterian denomination who still believe that these are absolutely critical doctrines to our faith. And so some of the disagreements that you've been hearing about in the denomination for years, those are the surface. Those are the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg that is under the water is all of this stuff. There are vast, vast differences in how much people believe and how much they don't related to these things. Now, I had an Old Testament professor at Princeton, Old Testament theology professor, by the name of Dennis Olson, and he was quick to point out about the Genesis story that, you know, there are some myths that have gone along over the years that we need to debunk related to the Genesis story that helps us think about original sin a little bit. So the first one being, of course, we all think it's an apple that Eve ate and then gave to Adam. It never says it was an apple. It was just fruit of some kind. So that's myth number one. Myth number two is there is nowhere in the Genesis story that it says God created a perfect world. Nowhere. God created in one of the stories and at the end of creation called it good. Not perfect, good. So that's important. Another one is that, as was read in our scripture reading, after God had created Adam, God put Adam in the garden to till it and work it prior to any punishment. So Dr. Olson likes to point out, it wasn't like this great Club Med kind of thing that was going on in the Garden of Eden. There was already work and responsibility there. But somehow in our minds, we don't think there was early on. But there was work and there was responsibility. Now, another myth is that the serpent is sort of this Satan figure that comes in from the outside and kind of ruins the picture. And that's not what the story says. The serpent is one of the created creatures. And if you read the story a little differently, the serpent doesn't necessarily even do anything that's all that bad. It just kind of depends on how you hear it and how you read it. So the serpent was part of the creation that God had called good. Another one of the myths is that we have this idea that Eve is standing there, the serpent is trying to tempt her, she takes the apple and then somehow goes and finds Adam and says, here, you need to eat this apple too. Only what's probably much more accurate is that they were together. Adam was right there with Eve, silent, mind you, but right there with Eve. And so it wasn't necessarily the fact that Eve had to go seek him out and get him into trouble. They were right there together all along. God created a helpmeet for Adam, and they were together. Now, the last of the myth is this. The story was not told for the purpose of trying to figure out the origin of sin in the world. The real purpose of the story was to highlight this mystery that here is this creation that is good, and here is this part of creation that somehow kind of fell short, or doesn't quite make it, or makes choices that are against creation. Those things exist. And so we do better to picture the story, like I've said before, this is the Old Testament story, picture it as around the campfire, all the stories are being told, and somebody says, gee, you know, isn't it odd? Isn't it odd that on the one hand we can do all these good things, and on the other hand, sometimes we don't? I wonder what that's about. And then somebody tells this story. So it was never designed as a treatise about how sin entered the world. But we've used it that way. And so we would do well to examine what is it that we believe about ourselves, about humanity. Many of you are familiar with Matthew Fox, who has written a number of things. One of his books is Original Blessing. And in that book, he writes about the effect original sin has had. He says, you know, it causes fear, it causes depression, it causes all kinds of things. And what if we were to instead think of it as original goodness, original blessing, original wisdom? What if we were created in original wisdom, original goodness? How might we live in the world differently? How might we relate to the divine differently? If we were to see ourselves in that light, rather than to see ourselves as totally depraved, how might that change how we are and how we live in the world? So I want to encourage you to spend some time thinking about what you think about original sin, this doctrine that has been passed on. And if you decide you don't believe it, or don't believe all of it, or believe parts of it, what do you believe? What is it that we can reconstruct in its place? And I know that it has serious ramifications, because so many of the other doctrines that we have been built on and are connected to the doctrine of original sin. What Jesus is about, for many people, theologically, goes right back to the doctrine of original sin. So we're not just playing around, we're doing some deep work here. So think about it. Think about if you kind of lean more toward original blessing, original goodness, or toward original sin? Or is there something that we haven't even thought of yet? And what might that be? And next week we're going to look a little bit at salvation and start to unpack salvation and what impact and what it says about Jesus and what effect it has on our purpose as a church. So stay tuned. Think differently, accept uncertainty. Amen.